sagging where he sat. Not all the tracks on his face were sweat.
Marek, forgive me. Marek, your brother is dead. They killed him in the first ambush when he went to survey the river.
I backed away from the table as if I could escape from the words. The little boy upstairs holding out his sword.
I won't be any trouble.
His round face upturned. The memory jabbed me, knife sharp. Marek had gone silent. His face was bewildered more than anything. Soler went on speaking with the general a little longer. I could scarcely bear to hear them go on talking. Finally, Soler reached up and drew a heavy cloth down over the mirror. He turned to look at Marek. The bewilderment was fading.
By God, Marek said after a moment, I would rather not have it than have it so.
Sole only inclined his head, watching him with a gleam in his eye.
But that's not the choice, after all.
No, Sole agreed softly. It's just as well the Magnati are on their way. We'll hold the confirmation vote at once. There was salt in my mouth. I'd been crying without knowing it. I backed up farther. The doorknob came into my hand, the hollows and bumps of its carved hawk's head pressing into my palm. I turned it and slipped out the door and shut it behind me quietly. I stood trembling in the hallway. Alyosha had been right. One trap after another, long buried under a carpet of thick leaves, finally springing shut. Tiny seedlings pushing grasping branches out of the dirt. One trap after another. All at once I was running. I ran, my boots slapping on stone, past startled servants and the morning sun bright in all the windows. I was panting by the time I rounded the corner to the quarters of the Crown Prince. The door was shut, but unguarded. A thin gray haze trickled from underneath it into the hallway. The knob was hot under my hand as I threw the door open. The bed hangings were aflame, and the carpet scorched. The guards were dead, huddled heaps on the floor. There were 10 men in a silent knot around Alyosha. She was burned horribly, half her armor melted into her skin, and somehow still fighting. Behind her, the princess lay dead, barring the door to the wardrobe with her own body. Kasha was next to her corpse, her own clothes sliced in a dozen places, but her skin unmarked. She was holding a chipped sword and swinging it fiercely at two men trying to get past her. Alyosha was holding off the rest with two long knives that sang wildly in the air and left crackles of fire behind them. She'd cut them all to ribbons, blood slick on the floor, but they weren't falling down. The men wore Roshan uniforms, but their eyes were green and lost. The room smelled like a fresh birch tree branch, broken open down the middle. I wanted to scream, to weep. I wanted to drag my hand across the world and wipe it all away.
Hulvad,
I said, my hands pushing magic out with it.
Hulvad!
Remembering how Alyosha had pulled that thin cloud of corruption out of Balo's apprentice, and wisps of black smoke came streaming out of the men, out of every slash and knife wound. The smoke blew away through the open window into the sunlight, and then they were only men again, hurt too much to live. They fell to the ground one after another. With her attacker's gun, Alyosha turned and threw her knives at the men trying to kill Kasha. The knives sank deep into their backs, and more of that evil smoke billowed out from around the blades. They fell, one and two. The room was strangely quiet when they were all dead. The hinges on the wardrobe door squeaked. I jumped at the noise. The door pushed open a crack, and Kasha whirled towards it. Stashek was inside, trying to look out, his face scared, his small sword gripped in his hand.
Don't look,
she said. She pulled a cloak out of the wardrobe, long rich red velvet. She covered the children's heads with it and gathered them into her arms.
Don't look,
she said, and held them huddled close against her.
Mama,
the little girl said.
Be quiet,
the boy told her, his voice trembling. I covered my mouth with both my hands and crammed in a sob. Alyosha was dragging in heavy, labored breaths. Blood bubbled on her lips. She sagged against the bed. I stumbled forward and reached for her, but she waved me back. She made a hooking gesture with a hand and said, Hatal, and drew the killing sword out of the air. She held the hilt out to me.
Whatever's in the wood,
she said, hoarse and whispering, her voice eaten by the fire.
Find it and kill it before it's too late.
I took it and held it awkwardly. Alyosha was sliding to the floor even as she let it go into my hands. I knelt down beside her.
We have to get the willow,
I said. She shook her head, a tiny movement.
Go. Get the children out of here, she said. The castle's not safe. Go.
She let her head sink back against the bed, her eyes closing. Her chest rose and fell, only in shallow breaths. I stood up shaking. I knew she was right. I felt it. The king, the crown prince, now the princess. The wood, meant to kill all of them. Alyosha's good kings, and slaughter Polnia's wizard too. I looked at the dead soldiers and their Rosian uniforms. Marek would blame Rosia again, as he was meant to do. He'd put on his crown and march east, and after he spent our army slaughtering as many Rosians as he could, the wood would devour him too, and leave the country torn apart, the succession broken. I was in the wood again, underneath the boughs, that cold, hateful presence watching me. The momentary silence in the room was only its pause for breath. Stone walls and sunlight meant nothing. The wood's eyes were on us. The wood was here. Chapter 25. We wrapped ourselves in torn cloaks. We took off the dead guards and ran for it, our hams leaving streaks of blood on the floor behind us. I had shoved Alyosha's sword back into its strange waiting place, Hatol opening a pocket in the world for me to put it in. Kasha carried the little girl, and I held Stashek's hand. We went down a tower staircase, past a landing where two men in a hallway glanced over at us, puzzled and frowning. We hurried on down another turning, fast, and came into the narrow hallway to the kitchens, servants going back and forth. Stashek tried to pull back from me.
I want my father,
he said, his voice trembling.
I want Uncle Marek. Where are we going?
I didn't know. I was only in flight. All I knew was we had to get away. The wood had scattered too many seeds all around us. They'd lain quiet and fallow ground, but now they were all coming to fruit. Nowhere was safe when corruption lived in the king's castle. The princess had meant to take them to her parents, to Gidna, on the northern sea. The ocean is inimical to corruption, Alyosha had said. But trees still grew in Gidna, and the wood would pursue the children to the shore. To the tower, I said. I didn't plan on saying it. The words came out of me like Stashek's cry. I wanted the stillness of Sarkon's library, the faint spice and sulfur smell of his laboratory, those closed narrow hallways, the clean lines, and the emptiness, the tower standing tall and lonely against the mountains. The wood had no foothold there. We're going to the Dragon's Tower. Some of the servants were slowing, looking at us. There were footsteps on the stairs coming after us. A man called down with authority.
You there!
Hold on to me, I told Kasia. I put my hand on the castle wall and whispered us through, straight out into the kitchen gardens. One staring gardener kneeling up from the dirt. I ran between rows of bean stakes, with Stashek wide-eyed, running with me. Catching our fear, Kasia ran behind us. We reached the outer wall of heavy brick. I took us through. The castle bells began to clang alarm behind us, as we scrambled in a hail of dirt all the way down the steep slope to the Vandalus running below. The river rushed quick and deep here around the castle, leaving the city behind, going east. A hunting bird cried high above, a falcon, wheeling in wide circles around the castle. Was that Solya looking down at us? I snatched up a handful of reeds from the bank, without any incantations or charms. They had all gone out of my head. Instead, I pulled a thread out of my cloak and tied the reeds at two ends. I threw the bundle down on the bank, halfway in the water, and flung magic at it. It grew into a long, light boat, and we scrambled in, even as the river tugged it off the bank and dragged us along, rushing, bouncing off rocks on either side. There were shouts behind us, guards appearing on the outer walls of the castle high above. Down! Kasia shouted, and pushed the children down flat and covered them with her body. The guards were firing arrows at us. One tore through her cloak and hit her back. Another landed just beside me and stuck into the side of the boat, quivering. I snatched the feathers off the arrow shaft and threw them up into the air above us. They remembered what they'd once been and turned into a cloud of half-birds that whirled and sang, covering us from view for a few moments. I held on to the sides of the boat and called up Yaga's quickening charm. We shot forward. In one lurch, the castle and the city blurred back and away, turned into children's toys. In a second, they had vanished around a curve of the river. In a third, we struck on the empty riverbank. My boat of reeds fell apart around us and dumped us all into the water. I nearly sank. The weight of my clothes dragged me backwards, down into the murky water, light blurring above me. The cloud of Kasia's skirts billowed next to me. I thrashed for the surface, blindly grabbing, and found a small hand grabbing back. Stashek put my hand on a tree root. I pulled myself up, coughing, and managed to put my feet down in the water. Nyeshka! Kasia was calling. She was holding Marisha in her arms. We slugged up the soft, muddy bank, Kasia's feet sinking deep with every step, gouging holes in the earth that filled slowly in with water behind her. I sank down on the mucky grass. I was trembling with magic that wanted to spill out of me in every direction, uncontrolled. We'd moved too quickly. My heart was racing, still back there under the raining arrows, still in desperate flight, and not on a quiet deserted riverbank with water bugs jumping over the ripples we'd made, mud staining my skirts. I'd been so long inside the castle, people and stone walls everywhere. The riverbank almost didn't seem real. Stashek sat down in a heap next to me, his small serious face bewildered, and Marisha crept over to him and huddled against him. He put an arm around her. Kasia sat down on their other side. I could gladly have lain down and slept for a day, a week, but Marek knew which way we'd gone. Solya would send eyes down the river to look for us. There was no time to rest. I shaped a pair of crude oxen out of riverbank mud and breathed a little life into them and built a cart out of twigs. We hadn't been an hour on the road when Kasia said, Nyeshka, looking behind us, and I drove them quickly into a stand of trees some way back from the road. A small haze of dust was drifting up from the road behind us. I held the reins, the oxen standing with plodding obedience, and we all held our breath. The cloud grew unnaturally fast. It came nearer and nearer, and then A small troop of red-cloaked riders with crossbows and bared swords went flashing past. Sparks of magic were striking from the horses' hooves, shod in steel caps that rang like bells on the hard-packed road. Some work of Alyosha's hands now being turned to serve the wood. I waited until the cloud was out of sight again up ahead before I drove our cart back onto the road. When we drew into the first town, we found signs already posted. They were crudely, hastily drawn. A long parchment with my face and Kasha's upon it, pinned to a tree next to the church. I hadn't thought what it meant to be haunted. I'd been glad to see the town, planning to stop and buy food. Our stomachs were pinching with hunger. Instead, we pulled the cloaks over our heads and rolled onward without speaking to anyone. My hands shook on the reins all the way through, but we were lucky. It was market day, and the town was large, so close to the city. There were enough strangers around that no one marked us out or demanded to see our faces. As soon as we were past the buildings, I shook the reins and hurried the oxen onward, quicker, until the village disappeared entirely behind us. We had to pull off the road twice more, packs of horsemen flying past, and then once more, late that evening, when another king's messenger, in his red cloak, passed us going the other way, racing back towards Kralja, hoof sparks bright in the dimming light. He didn't see us, intent on his fast pace. We were just a shadow behind a hedge. While we were hiding, I caught sight of something dark and square behind us. It was the open doorway of an abandoned cottage, half lost in a stand of trees. While Kasha held the oxen, I hunted through the overgrown garden. A handful of late strawberries, some old turnips, onions, a few beans. We gave the children most of the food, and they fell asleep in the cart as we drove back onto the road. At least our oxen didn't need to eat or rest, being made out of dirt. They would march on all night long. Kasha climbed onto the driver's seat with me. The stars had come out in a rush, the sky wide and dark, so far away from anyone living. The air was cold, still, too quiet. The cart didn't creak, and the oxen didn't huff or snort. "You haven't tried to send word to their father," Kasha said quietly. I stared ahead, down the dark road. "He's dead, too," I said. "The Rossians ambushed him." Kasha carefully took my hand, and we held on to each other as the cart rocked onward. After a little while, she said, "The princess died next to me." She put the children in the wardrobe, and then she stood in front of it. They stabbed her over and over, and she just kept trying to stand up in front of the doors. Her voice shook. "Nyeshka, can you make a sword for me?" I didn't want to. Of course it was only sensible to give her one, in case we were caught. I didn't fear for her. Kasha would be safe enough fighting, when blades just went dull on her skin and arrows fell away without scratching her. But she would be dangerous and terrible with a sword. She wouldn't need a shield or armor, or even to think. She could walk through fields of soldiers, like cutting oats, steady and rhythmic. I thought of Alyosha's sword, that strange, hungry, killing thing. It was tucked away into that magical pocket, but I could still feel its weight on my back. Kasha would be like that sword, implacable. But she wouldn't only have one use. I didn't want her to need to do things like that. I didn't want her to need a sword. It was a useless thing to want. I took out my belt knife, and she gave me hers. I pulled the buckles off our belts and our shoes, and the pins of our cloaks, and took a stick off a tree as we passed it, and gathered all of it together in my skirt. While Kasha drove, I told them all to be straight and sharp and strong. I hummed them the song about the seven knights, and in my lap they listened and grew together into a long, curved blade, with a single, sharpened edge, like a kitchen knife instead of a sword, with small bright steel posts to hold the wooden hilt around it. Kasha picked it up and balanced it across her hands, and then she nodded once and put it down under the seat. We were 3 days on the road, the mountains growing steadily overnight, comforting in the distance. The oxen made a good pace, but we still had to duck behind hedges and hillocks and abandoned cottages every time riders came by, a steady stream of them. At first I was only glad whenever we managed to hide from them, too busy with fear and relief to think anything more about it. But while we peered over a hedge, watching a cloud vanishing away ahead, Kasha said, "They keep coming." And a cold hard knot settled into the bottom of my stomach as I realized there had been too many of them just to be passing the word to look for us. They were doing something more. If Marek had ordered the mountain passes closed, if his men had blockaded the tower, if they'd gone after Sarkhan himself, taking him by surprise while he fought to hold the wood off from Zatochik, there wasn't anything to do but keep going. But the mountains weren't a comfort anymore. We didn't know what we would find when we got to the other side. Kasha rode in the back of the cart with the children all that day, as the road began to gently climb into the foothills, her hand on the sword hidden beneath her cloak. The sun climbed high, warm golden light shining full on her face. She looked remote and strange, inhumanly steady. We reached the top of a hill and found the final crossroads in the yellow marshes, a small well beside it with a watering trough. The road was empty, although it had been trampled heavily on both sides by feet and horses. I couldn't guess if it was only ordinary traffic or not. Kasha pulled up buckets for us to drink and wash our dusty faces. And then I mixed some fresh mud to patch up the oxen. They cracked here and there after a day's walking. Stashik silently brought me handfuls of muddy grass. We told the children, as gently as we could, about their father. Marisha didn't quite understand, except to be afraid. She'd asked for her mother a few times already. Now she clung to Kasha's skirts almost all the time, like a smaller child, and didn't go out of sight of her. Stashik understood too well. He received the news in silence, and afterwards he said to me, "Did Uncle Marek try to have us killed?" "I am not a child," he added, looking at my face as if I needed him to say so, when he'd just asked me such a thing. "No," I managed through my tight throat. "He's only letting the wood drive him." I wasn't sure Stashik believed me. He'd been quiet ever since. He was patient with Marisha, who clung to him too, and helped with the work whenever he could. But he said almost nothing. "Agnieszka," he said, while I finished plastering up the second oxen's hind leg and stood up to go wash the dirt off my hands. I turned to follow his gaze. We could see a long way back behind us, miles and miles. In the west, a thick, hazy cloud of dust covered the road. It seemed to move, coming onward as we stood watching. Kasha picked Marisha up. I shaded my eyes and squinted against the sun. It was a crowd of men marching. Thousands of them. A stand of tall spears glittered at the front, among riders on horses and a great banner flying white and red. I saw a bay horse leading, a silver-armored figure on its back. Next to it, a gray horse with a white-cloaked rider. The world tilted askew, narrowed, rushed in on me. Soli's face leaped vividly out. He was looking right at me. I jerked my head away so hard that I fell down. "Agnieszka?" Kasha said. "Quick!" I panted, scrambling up, pushing Stashik towards the back of the cart. "He saw me." We drove into the mountains. I tried to guess how far behind us the army was. I would have whipped the oxen, if that would have done any good. But they were going as fast as they could. The road was tumbled with rocks, narrow and twisting, and their legs began to crack and crumble quickly. There wasn't any mud to patch them with anymore, even if I could have brought myself to stop. I didn't dare use the quickening spell. I couldn't see beyond the next turn. What if there were men up ahead, and I whisked us straight into their arms? Or worse yet, I threw us into mid-air over a canyon. The left ox abruptly tumbled forward, its leg crumbling away, and smashed into clods of dirt against the rocks. The second one pulled us on a little farther, and then between one step and the next, just fell apart. The cart tipped forward, unbalanced, and we all came down hard on our seats in a pile of twigs and dry grass. We were deep in the mountains by then. The trees wizened and scrubby, and high peaks on either side of the twisting road. We couldn't see far enough behind us to tell how close the army was. Usually it was a day's walk across the pass. Kasha picked up Marisha, and Stasha got to his feet. He walked beside me, doggedly, uncomplaining, while we hurried, feet sore, and the sharp thin air painful in our throats. We stopped to catch our breath by a jutting outcrop with a tiny summer stream trickling, just enough to cup a handful for our mouths. And as I straightened up, a raucous cawing near my head made me jump. A black crow with glossy feathers stared at me from the branch of a wizened tree clinging between rocks. It cawed again, loudly. The crow paced us as we fled, hopping from branch to rock to rock. I threw a pebble at it, trying to make it go away. It only jumped away and cawed again, a sour triumphant note. Two more joined it a little farther on. The path snaked along the crest of the ridge, green grass rolling gently away to either side down to steep slopes. We kept running. The path dived as one mountain pulled away from it, leaving a sickening drop to the right. Maybe we were past the peak by now. I couldn't stop running long enough to think about it properly. I nearly dragged Stashek along by his arm. Somewhere behind us, I heard a hoarse shriek, as if it had slipped, running too fast on the narrow mountain pass. The crows lifted into the air, circling, and went to go and see. All except for our one steady companion, hopping along, its bright eyes fixed on us. The air was thin. We struggled and gasped for air as we ran. The sun was sinking. "Stop!" someone far behind us shouted, and an arrow sailed down, clattering against the rocks over our heads. Kasha stopped, pushed Marisha into my arms when I caught up to her, and took the place at the rear. Stashek threw a frightened look back at me. "Keep going," I said. "Keep going until you see the tower." Stashek pelted on and vanished with the trail around a wall of rock. I heaved Marisha up close against me, her arms wrapping tight around my neck and her legs around my waist, clinging, and ran after him. The horses were so close we could hear pebbles crunching under their hooves.
"I can see it!"
Stashek was calling from up ahead. "Hold on tight," I told Marisha, and ran as fast as I could, her body bumping against me. She tucked her cheek down against my shoulder and didn't speak. Stashek turned anxiously as I came panting around the curve. He was standing on the ledge, jutting out from the mountainside, almost wide enough to be a meadow. My legs were spent. I spilled to the ground, just barely keeping my knees long enough to put Marisha down without falling on top of her. We'd come out onto the southern slopes. Below us, the path continued to snake back and forth across the mountain all the way down to Alshanka. And on the other side of the town, in front of the western mountains, the Dragon's Tower stood gleaming white in the sun, still small and far away. It was ringed around with soldiers, a small army of men in yellow surcoats. I stared at it desperately. Had they gotten inside? The great doors were still closed. There was no smoke coming from the windows. I didn't want to believe the tower had fallen. I wanted to shout Sarkhan's name. I wanted to fling myself across the yawning air. I got back up on my feet. Kasia had stopped in the narrow road behind us. She drew out the sword I'd given her, even as the horses came around the curve. Marek was with them, leading. His spurs were wet with blood, and he had his sword drawn, his teeth bared in a snarl. His bay came charging, and Kasia didn't move. Her hair was flying loose, streaming in the wind. She planted her feet wide in the trail and held the sword out straight, and Marek had to yank aside the horse's head or ride directly onto the blade. He pulled up, but smashed his own sword down at her as he twisted the horse on the narrow path. Kasia caught the blow and whacked it aside with pure brute strength. She knocked the sword straight out of Marek's hand. It struck the edge of the path and fell over, disappearing down the mountainside with a wash of pebbles and dust. "A pike!" Marek shouted, and a soldier threw him one. He caught it easily, even as he wheeled his horse around on the path. He brought the pike around in a long, low sweep that nearly caught Kasia at the waist. She had to jump back. If he could knock her off the path, it wouldn't matter that she was stronger than he was. She tried to grab for the end of the pike, but Marek jerked it back too quickly. Then he immediately nudged his horse forward and pulled it up into a crow-stepping rear, iron-shod hooves lashing towards her head. He was herding her back. As soon as he reached the place where the road widened, he and the other soldiers would spill out and surround her. They could come past her at us, at the children. I groped for the dragon spell, the transport spell, Valisu and Zokinesh. But even while I tried to fit the words together, I knew somehow that it wasn't going to work. We weren't in the valley yet. That path wasn't open to us. My head was light with thin air and desperation. Stashek had picked up Marisha and was holding her tight. I shut my eyes and spoke the illusion spell. I called up Sarkhan's library, shelves rising up out of bare rock around us, golden lettered spines, and the smell of leather. The clockwork bird in its cage, the window looking out on the whole green length of the valley and the winding river. I even saw us in the illusion, tiny ant figures on the mountainside, moving. There was a line of 20 men strung out on the trail behind Marek. If he could only shove his way into the wider ground, they would be on us. I knew the dragon wasn't there. He was in the east, in Zatochek, where the thin column of smoke rose from the edge of the wood. But I put him in the library anyway, at the table, the hard angles of his face lit by the candles that never melted, looking at me with that annoyed, baffled expression. "Now what are you doing?" "Help me," I said to him, and gave Stashek a push. The dragon put his hands out automatically, and the children tumbled into them together. Stashek cried out, and I saw him stare up at the dragon with wide eyes. Sarkhan stared down at him. I turned back, half in the library, half on the mountain. "Kasia!" I cried. "Go!" she shouted at me. One of the soldiers behind Marek had a clear view of me and the library behind me. He slung a bow down and stretched an arrow, taking aim. Kasia ducked under the pike and ran at Marek's horse and shoved the animal bodily back, both hands on its chest. It squealed and reared up, hopping back on its rear legs and lashing at her. Marek kicked her, snapping back her chin, and shoved the shaft of the pike down between them, just behind her ankle. He had both hands on the pike now. He dropped his reins, but somehow he made the horse do what he wanted anyway. The animal turned. He twisted his body as it did, gripping the pike, and he tripped Kasha up. The horse's hindquarters struck her and swept her, stumbling to the edge of the path, and Marek gave a quick, massive heave. She fell over. She didn't even have time to scream. Just gave a startled "Ah!" and was gone, dragging a clump of grass loose as she grabbed at it. "Kasha!" I screamed. Marek turned towards me. The bowman let the arrow loose. The string twanged. Hands seized my shoulders, gripping with familiar, unexpected strength. They dragged me backwards. The walls of the library rushed forward around me and closed up just before the arrow would have passed through them. The whistle of the wind, the cold, crisp air, faded from my skin. I whirled, staring. Sarkhan was there. He was standing right behind me. He'd pulled me through. His hands were still on my shoulders. I was braced on his chest. I was full of alarm and a thousand questions, but he dropped his hands and stepped back, and I realized we weren't alone. A map of the valley lay unrolled on the table, and an enormous, broad-shouldered man with a beard longer than his head and a shirt of mail under a yellow surcoat stood at the far end of it, gawking at us, with four armored men behind him gripping the hilts of their swords.
"Kasha!"
Marisha was crying in Stashek's arms and struggling against his grip.
"I want Kasha!"
I wanted Kasha too. I was still shaking with the memory of watching her tumble over the edge. How far could she fall without being hurt? I ran to the window. We were far away, but I could see the thin plume of dust where she'd fallen, like a line drawn down the side of the mountain. She was a tiny dark heap of brown cloak and golden hair on the trail, 100 feet down where it sloped back on itself down the mountain. I tried to gather my wits and my magic. My legs still shook with exhaustion. "No," Sarkhan said, coming to my side. "Stop. I don't know how you've done any of this, and I imagine I'll be appalled when I learn. But you've been too profligate with your magic for 1 hour." He pointed his finger out the window at the tiny huddled heap of Kasha's body, his eyes narrowing. "Twalid et al," he said, and clenched his hand into a fist, jerked it quickly back, and pointed his finger to an open place on the floor. Kasha tumbled out of the air where he pointed, and spilled to the floor, trailing brown dust. She rolled and got up quickly, staggering only a little. There were some bloody scrapes on her arms, but she'd kept hold of her sword. She took one look at the armed men on the other side of the table and caught Stashek by the shoulder. She pulled him behind her and held the sword out like a bar.
"Hush, Marishu,"
she said, a quick touch of her hand to Marisha's cheek to quiet her. The little girl was trying to reach for her. The big man had only been staring all this while. He said suddenly,
"God in heaven! Sarkhan, that's the young prince!"
"Yes, I imagine so," Sarkhan said.
He sounded resigned. I stared at him, still half disbelieving he was really there. He was thinner than when I'd seen him last, and almost as disheveled as I was. Soot streaked his cheek and neck, and had left a fine thin layer of gray over all his skin, enough that a line showed at the loose collar of his shirt, where it gaped open, to divide clean skin from dirty. He wore a rough long coat of leather hanging open. The edges of the sleeves and the bottom hem were singed black, and the whole length of it patterned with scorch marks. He looked as though he'd come straight from burning the wood. I wondered wildly if I'd somehow summoned him here with my spell. Peering from behind Kasha, Stashek said,
"Baron Vladimir."
He hitched Marisha up a little in his arms, protectively, and looked at Sarkhan.
"Are you the dragon?"
he asked,
his high young voice wavering and doubtful, as if thinking he didn't quite look the part.
Agnieszka brought us here to keep us safe, he added, even more doubtfully.
Of course she did, Sarkan said. He looked out the window. Marek and his men were already riding down the sloping trail, and not alone. The long marching line of the army was coming out of the mountain pass, their feet raising a sunset golden cloud of dust that rolled down towards Alshanka like a fog. The dragon turned back to me. Well, he said caustic, you've certainly brought more men. Chapter 26.
He must have scraped together every soldier in the south of Polnia,
the Baron of the Yellow Marshes said, studying Marek's army. He was a big, comfortably barrel-bellied man who wore his armor as easily as clothes. He wouldn't have seemed out of place in our village tavern. He'd just gotten the summons to come to the capital for the king's funeral, when Marek's magic sped messenger had arrived, told him that the crown prince was dead too, and gave him his orders to go over the mountains, seize Sarkan as corrupted and a traitor, and lay a trap for me and the children. The baron nodded, gave orders for his soldiers to gather, and waited until the messenger had left. Then he'd brought his men over the pass and gone straight to Sarkan to tell him there was some kind of corrupt deviltry going on in the capital. They'd come back to the tower together, and those were his soldiers encamped below. They were hastily putting up fortifications for a defense.
But we can't hold out for longer than a day. Not against that, the baron said, jerking his thumb out the window at the army pouring down the mountainside. So you'd better have something up your sleeve. I told my wife to write to Marek that I'd lost my mind and gone corrupted, so I hope he won't behead her and the children. But I'd as soon keep my own head on, too.
Can they break down the doors? I asked.
If they try long enough, Sarkan said. And the walls, for that matter.
He pointed to a pair of wooden carts trundling down the mountainside, carrying the long iron barrels of cannon.
Enchantment won't hold against cannon fire forever.
He turned away from the window.
You know, we've already lost, he said to me bluntly. Every man we kill, every spell and potion we waste, it all serves the wood. We could take the children to their mother's family and marshal a fresh defense in the north, around Gidna.
He wasn't saying anything I didn't know. Hadn't known even when I'd come flying home like a bird to its burning nest. No, I said.
Listen to me, he said. I know your heart is in this valley. I know you can't let it go.
Because I'm bound to it? I said sharply. Me? And all the other girls you choose? I'd tumbled into his library with an army at my heels and half a dozen people around us, and there hadn't been time for conversation, but I still hadn't forgiven him. I wanted to get him alone and shake him until answers came out, and shake him a little more for good measure. He fell silent, and I forced myself to push aside the hot anger. I knew this wasn't the time.
That's not why, I said instead.
The wood could reach into the king's castle in Kralja, a week's journey from here. Do you think there is anywhere we can take the children that the wood can't reach? At least here, we have a chance of victory. But if we run, if we let the wood take back the whole valley, we'll never raise an army anywhere that can fight all the way through to its heart.
Unfortunately, he said sharp, the one we have now is pointing the wrong way.
Then we need to persuade Marek to turn it around, I said. Kasha and I took the children down to the cellars, the safest place, and we made up a pallet for them of straw and spare blankets from the shelves. The kitchen stores were untouched by time, and we were all hungry enough, after our day of running, that not even worry could stifle our appetite. I took a rabbit from the cold store in back and put it in the pot with some carrots and dried buckwheat and water, and threw lirintilim at it to make it into something edible. We all wolfed it down together without bothering with bowls, and almost at once the children collapsed into an exhausted sleep, curled together.
I'll stay with them, Kasha said, sitting down beside the pallet.
She put her sword unsheathed next to her and rested a hand on Marisha's sleeping head. I mixed up a simple dough in a big bowl, just flour paste and salt, and I carried it upstairs to the library. Outside, the soldiers had put up Marek's tent, a white pavilion with two tall spell lamps planted in the ground before it. Their blue light gave the white fabric an unearthly glow, as though the whole pavilion had descended straight from heaven, which I imagine was the idea. The king's banner was snapping in the wind atop the highest point, the red eagle, with its mouth and its talons open, crowned. The sun was sinking. The long shadow of the western mountains was creeping slowly over the valley. A herald came out and stood between the lamps, official and stark in a white uniform with a heavy golden chain of office around his neck. Another piece of Ragastok's working. It drew his voice against the tower walls, like the blast of righteous trumpets. He was recounting all our crimes, corruption, treason, murdering the king, murdering Princess Malgorzata, murdering Father Balo, conspiring with the traitor Alyosha, the abduction of Prince Casimir Stanislav Algirdon and Princess Regulinda Maria Algirdon. It took me a moment to realize they meant Stashek and Marisha, consorting with the enemies of Polnia, and going on from there. I was glad to hear them name Alyosha a traitor. Maybe that meant she was still alive. The list finished with a demand for the return of the children and our immediate surrender. Afterwards, the herald paused for breath and to take a drink of water. Then he began to recite the gruesome litany all over again. The baron's men milled uneasily around the base of the tower, where they were encamped, and looked up askance towards our windows.
Yes, Marek seems eminently persuadable, Sarkan said as he came into the room.
Faint smears of oil glistened on his throat and the back of his hand and across his forehead. He had been brewing up potions of sleep and forgetfulness in his laboratory.
What do you mean to do with that? I doubt Marek is going to eat a poisoned loaf of bread, if that was your notion.
I turned my dough out onto the smooth marble top of the long table. I had the vague thought of the oxen in my head, the way I'd cobbled them together. They'd crumbled, but they'd only been made of mud.
Do you have any sand? I asked.
And maybe some small pieces of iron. I kneaded iron shavings and sand into my dough, while the herald chanted on outside. Sarkan sat across from me, his pen scratching out a long incantation of illusion and dismay put together from his books. An hourglass streamed sand between us, marking time while his potions brewed. A few unhappy soldiers from the baron were waiting for him while he worked, shifting from foot to foot uneasily in the corner of the room. He put down his pen, just as the last few grains of sand spilled, precisely timed.
All right, come with me, he told them, and took them along to the laboratory to give them the flasks to carry downstairs.
But I hummed my mother's baking songs while I worked, folding and folding in a steady rhythm. I thought of Alyosha, forging her blade again and again, working a little more magic in each time. When my dough was pliable and smooth, I broke off a piece, rolled it into a tower in my hands, and planted it in the middle, folding up the dough on one side to make the wall of the mountains behind us. Sarkan came back into the room and scowled down at my work.
A charming model, he said. I am sure the children will be entertained.
Come and help me, I said.
I pinched up a wall around the tower out of the soft dough and started to murmur a chant of earth spells over it. Fulmadesh, Fulmista. Back and forth, in a steady rhythm. I built a second wall, farther out, then a third. I kept humming softly to them. A groaning sound, like trees in a high wind, came in from outside the window. And the floor trembled faintly beneath us, earth and stone waking up. Sarkhan watched, frowning a while longer. I felt his eyes on the back of my neck. The memory curled in me of the last time we'd worked together in this room. Roses and thorns sprawling furiously everywhere between us. I wanted and didn't want his help. I wanted to stay angry with him a little longer, but I wanted the connection more. I wanted to touch him, wanted the brilliant crisp bite of his magic in my hands. I kept my head down and kept working. He turned and went to one of his cabinets. He brought over a small drawer full of chips of stone that looked like the same great granite as the tower, of varied sizes. He began to gather the chips up and with his long fingers pressed them into the walls I'd built. He recited a spell of repairing as he worked, a spell of mending cracks and patching stone. His magic came running through the clay, vivid and bright where it brushed against mine. He brought the stone into the spell, laying the deep foundations beneath, lifting me and my working higher, like putting steps beneath me so I could take the walls up into clear air. I drew his magic into my working, running my hands back along the walls, my chant still marching away beneath the melody of his spell. I darted a quick glance at him. He was staring down at the dough, trying to keep his scowl, and flushed at the same time with the high transcendent light that he brought to his elaborate workings. Delighted and also annoyed, trying not to be. Outside the sun had gone down. A faint blue-violet glow flickered over the surface of the dough, like strong liquor burning off in a pot. I could just barely make it out in the dim twilight of the room. Then, the working went up like dry kindling. There was a jolt, a rush of magic, but this time, Sarkhan was ready for the dam bursting. Even as the spell caught, he pulled abruptly back from me. Instinctively, I reached after him at first, but then I pulled back too. We fell away into our separate skins, instead of spilling magic all over each other. A cracking noise, like winter ice breaking, came in through the window, and shouts rose. I hurried past Sarkhan, my face hot, to go and look. The spell lamps outside Marek's tent were rolling slowly up and down, as if they were lanterns on boats climbing a wave. The ground was shuddering like water. The Baron's men all backed hastily to the tower walls. Their thin fence work, little more than heaped bundles of sticks they'd gathered, was falling apart. In the spell light, I saw Marek come ducking out of his tent, hair and armor shining brilliant, and a gold chain. The gold chain the herald had been wearing, gripped in his fist. A scurrying crowd of men and servants poured out behind him, escaping. The whole great pavilion was collapsing. "Put out the torches and the fires!" Marek bellowed, his voice unnaturally loud. The earth groaned and rumbled all around with complaining voices. Solya came out of the pavilion with the others. He seized one of the spell lamps out of the ground and held it up with a sharp word that brightened it. The ground between the tower and the encampment was heaved and hunched up like some complaining lazy beast getting to its feet. Stone and earth began to rear themselves into three high walls around the tower, made of fresh quarried stone, laced full of white veins and jagged edges. Marek had to give orders for his men to pull the cannon back quickly, the rising walls pulling the ground out from under their feet. The ground settled, sighing out. A few final tremors shuddered away from the tower, like ripples, and died away. Small showers of dirt and pebbles ran off the walls. Marek's face in the light was baffled and furious. For one moment he looked up straight at me, glaring. I glared right back. Sarkan dragged me away from the window.
You won't persuade Marek to listen any sooner by provoking him into a high rage, he said when I wheeled on him, forgetting to be embarrassed in my anger.
We were standing very close. He noticed the same moment that I did. He let go of me abruptly and stepped back. He looked aside and put up his hand to wipe a trickle of sweat from the side of his forehead. He said,
We'd better go down and tell Vladimir that he needn't worry. We aren't planning to drop him and all his soldiers into the center of the earth.
You might have warned us ahead of time, the Baron said dryly when we came outside. But I won't complain too much. We can make him pay for these walls, more than he can afford, as long as we can move between them ourselves. The stones are cutting up our ropes. We need a way through.
He wanted us to make two tunnels at opposite ends of the walls from each other, so he could make Marek fight the whole length of the walls to get through each one. Sarkan and I went to the northern end to begin. The soldiers were already laying pikes along the wall by torchlight, with the points bristling upwards. They had draped cloaks over the poles to make small tents to sleep under. A few of them were sitting around small campfires, soaking dried meat in boiling water, stirring kasha into the broth to cook up. They cleared hastily out of our way, without our even having to say a word, afraid. Sarkan seemed not to notice, but I couldn't help feeling sorry and strange and wrong. One of the soldiers was a boy my own age, industriously sharpening pike heads one by one with a stone, skillfully, 6 strokes for each one, and done as quick as the 2 men putting them along the wall could come back for them. He must have put himself to it, to learn how to do it so well. He didn't look sullen or unhappy. He'd chosen to go for a soldier. Maybe he had a story that began that way. A poor widowed mother at home, and 3 young sisters to feed, and a girl from down the lane who smiled at him over the fence as she drove her father's herd out into the meadows every morning. So he'd given his mother his signing money and gone to make his fortune. He worked hard. He meant to be a corporal soon, and after that a sergeant. He'd go home then, in his fine uniform, and put silver in his mother's hands, and ask the smiling girl to marry him. Or maybe he'd lose a leg, and go home sorrowful and bitter to find her married to a man who could farm. Or maybe he'd take to drink to forget that he'd killed men in trying to make himself rich. That was a story too. They all had stories. They had mothers or fathers, sisters or lovers. They weren't alone in the world, muttering to no one but themselves. It seemed utterly wrong to treat them like pennies in a purse. I wanted to go and speak to that boy, to ask him his name, to find out what his story really was. But that would have been dishonest. A sop to my own feelings. I felt the soldiers understood perfectly well that we were making sums out of them. This many, safe to spend. This number, too high. As if each one wasn't a whole man. Sarkan snorted. What good would it do them for you to roam around asking them questions? So you know, that one's from Debna. And this one's father is a tailor. And the other one has 3 children at home. They're better served by your building walls to keep Marek's soldiers from killing them in the morning. They'd be better served by Marek not trying in the first place, I said, impatient with him for refusing to understand. The only way we could make Marek bargain was to make the walls too costly to breach, so he wouldn't want to pay. But it still made me angry, at him, at the Baron, at Sarkhan, at myself. "Have you got any family left?" I asked